Lucky Land Casino, asking people, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
Lucky? In line at the deli, I guess?
Aha, in my dentist's office. More than once, actually.
Do I have to say?
Yes, you do.
In the car, before my kids' PTA meeting.
Really?
Yes.
Excuse me, what's the weirdest place you've gotten lucky?
I never win and tell.
Well, there you have it. You can get lucky anywhere, playing at LuckyLandSlots.com. Play for free right now. Are you feeling lucky? No purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. 18 plus. Terms and conditions apply. See website for details.
It is Ryan here, and I have a question for you. What do you do when you win? Like, are you a fist pumper, a woo-hooer, a hand clapper, a high-fiver? I kind of like the high-five, but if you want to hone in on those winning moves, check out Chumba Casino. At ChumbaCasino.com, choose from hundreds of social casino-style games for your chance to redeem serious cash prizes. There are new game releases weekly, plus free daily bonuses, so don't wait. Start having the most fun ever at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Blog Talk Radio.
You are now listening to True Murder, the most shocking killers in true crime history, and the authors that have written about them. Gacy, Bundy, Dahmer, The Night Stalker, BTK. Every week, another fascinating author talking about the most shocking and infamous killers in true crime history. True Murder, with your host, journalist and author, Dan Zupansky.
Good evening. Was Jason the monster who bludgeoned his beautiful wife to death, leaving his toddler alone for hours to walk through her blood? If so, would he get away with it? To the outside world, Jason and Michelle Young lived a storybook life. An attractive couple with great jobs, a beautiful home, a precocious 2-year-old daughter, and a baby boy on the way. Soon after the 29-year-old pregnant mother's brutally beaten body was discovered on their bedroom floor, a very different picture emerged, of a marriage crumbling at its foundation, of a meddlesome New York mother-in-law whose running critique left Jason frustrated and angry, of a 32-year-old man who behaved like a frat boy rebelling against adult responsibilities. Murder on Birchleaf Drive documents the gripping tale of a family's marathon quest for justice, confounding crime scene evidence, persistence of law enforcement officers, and riveting courtroom combat. The book that we're featuring this evening is Murder on Birchleaf Drive, the true story of the Michelle Young murder case, with my special guest, attorney and author Stephen B. Epstein. Welcome to the program, and thank you very much for this interview. Stephen B. Epstein.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for this. I want to ask how you came to be the author of Murder on Birchleaf Drive. What was it about this story? Tell us the circumstances in which you happen to be and want to write Murder on Birchleaf Drive.
Well, It really was a light bulb epiphany one day a couple of years ago. I had kept up with this story as someone living in Raleigh, North Carolina, following the news. And this story about this murder that occurred in November of 2006 was on the news a lot. There were two different criminal trials, which I suppose we'll talk about during today's interview. And that the trials were covered a lot. And as someone who's a lawyer, I was, of course, interested. I knew the judge that was involved in the case. I knew some of the lawyers involved in the case. But I think what really drew me to this story was that I shared some common pathways with the victim, Michelle Young. She grew up in Long Island and used a computer in her high school to find her way to North Carolina to go to college. She wound up going to North Carolina State University in Raleigh. I pretty much did the same thing. I grew up in Long Island, and I used a computer in my high school to find my way to North Carolina. I wound up going to the University of North Carolina. But I moved to a place that was foreign, as did she. The culture in the South is quite different than the culture in New York. And I married a Southerner and had to learn all of the things that were different about the South and the culture in the South, and she did as well. Jason Young grew up in Brevard, North Carolina, in the mountains, and there were a lot of culture clashes between Michelle and Jason and between their two families that were prominent in the problems in their relationship that ultimately, if you believe that Jason is the one who killed her, ultimately led to him committing this despicable act. There was a lot about this story that I was attracted to just as basically a reader of newspapers and as someone who watched little bits of news here and there about this trial. And no one else had written this book. I think that was the thing that I eventually pushed me to write it, is that I believe this was a story that really needed to be told, and that others around not only Raleigh and around North Carolina, but around the country would find to be a very fascinating true crime story. And that's why I decided to write the book.
And certainly that was a great decision. You take the reader November 3rd, 2006, and a phone ringing, awaking Meredith Fisher. And the call is from, or the message, is brother-in-law Jason Young. And this is her sister's husband, Michelle. Tell us what that phone ringing means. Does he leave a message? Does she talk to Jason Young personally? Tell us about that phone call. November 3rd, 2006.
So the book begins with the phone in Meredith Fisher's cell phone ringing in her bedroom, waking her from a dead sleep at 12:14 p.m. on November 3rd, 2006. Because she's asleep, she doesn't answer. Eventually, she sets the phone down and listens to the voicemail, which is from her brother-in-law, Jason Young. And what Jason Young says in that voicemail is that he had left some papers on the printer in his home on Birch Leaf Drive in Raleigh, North Carolina, at the time he departed for a business trip by car to Virginia. And those papers that he said he left on the printer were of auctions that were taking place on eBay for Coach purses. And what he says is that he had intended to take those with him on his business trip because he was trying to figure out the perfect gift for Michelle for their third wedding anniversary. Now, mind you, this call was on November 3rd, 2006. Their third wedding anniversary was on October 10th, 2006, a few weeks before. Nevertheless, he says he really wants Meredith to run the 20 minutes over to his home, pull those off of the printer, and get them before his wife sees them because he didn't want them to spoil her surprise that he was thinking of getting her a Coach purse for their anniversary. And that's what eventually leads to Meredith heading to 5108 Birch Leaf Drive, the home that was shared by Jason Young, Michelle Young, and their two-year-old daughter, Cassidy.
Now, what does Meredith find when she pulls up there? Does she find anything unusual at the home when she arrives?
She finds several things that are unusual before she even enters the home. For one, at that point in time, it was about an hour later, about 1:15 in the afternoon, and the lights at the top of the brick pillars at the driveway edge were still illuminated, which, being in the middle of the afternoon, didn't make any sense. She noticed that the gate that kept the backyard closed was open, which was odd because the Youngs had a black lab dog named Mr. Garrison, who was often allowed to roam free in the backyard, and seeing that gate open was very unusual. So those are the first two things she noticed. She got to the front door, and she heard Mr. Garrison inside whimpering, which seemed a little bit unusual. Unfortunately, she didn't have a key. She thought she had a key, but then she realized that she had let a friend borrow the key while she and Jason and Michelle were in New York on a vacation a little while earlier. So she didn't have a key to get in. She eventually realized that the garage door was broken, and she was able to slip underneath the crack of the garage door by pushing it up just enough to get her body inside. And she noticed that Michelle's Lexus SUV was inside of the garage, which also was very odd because she should have been at work at Progress Energy, where she was a financial specialist in the accounting department. So all those things were unusual before she even opened the door to enter the home.
Now, once she enters, she has any suspicions whatsoever, despite having seen these unusual things. What is her mindset as she walks into this home?
Well, her mindset is there's a lot that's unusual, but she wasn't able to piece together anything until she got upstairs, and then it all became very clear. But she walks into the home through the unlocked door leading from the garage into the kitchen, and she notices that Michelle's purse is lying on the floor against a leg of a small desk, which suggests to her that Michelle must be in the house, and she starts crying out, "Michelle, Michelle," and there's no response. And then she proceeds up the front stairway and gets to the top of the staircase, and out of her peripheral vision on her right, she sees Cassidy's bathroom, and she notices that there are footprints on Cassidy's bathroom floor. And then she looks at the landing just at the top of the staircase, and she notices that there are similar footprints on the carpeting on the landing. And those footprints, she realizes, that are actually in the color red, are just large enough to be a toddler's set of footprints, and so they were clearly Cassidy's footprints. But even then, she's thinking Cassidy must have gotten into Michelle's red hair dye, and she's thinking Michelle must be pissed. So she doesn't clue in at that point that those footprints were made in blood. She then turns to the left to face the master bedroom, and she takes a few steps to the entranceway of the master bedroom, and then she sees, in addition to red streaks on the walls and red spots on the walls and on the bed, she sees in between the bed, on the far side of the bed, and some closet doors, she sees her sister's lifeless body lying on the floor, soaked in blood. And that's when she realized that her sister has been attacked, and she immediately goes to the phone to call 911.
You talk about her sister Michelle laying face down in this, now realizes, Meredith realizes, is a pool of blood. You say while she's looking in horror and shock at her lifeless sister's body, there's a rustling under the covers.
That's exactly right. So right about the same time she punches in the numbers 911 at the near side of the bed, which is actually Jason's side of the bed, there's a rustling under the covers, and then the covers are pulled down, and there staring at her is her 2.5-year-old niece, Cassidy, unharmed. And Cassidy looks at her, she looks back at Cassidy, and then Cassidy leaps forward to her and clings to her hip like a koala bear, while Meredith proceeds to begin the conversation with the 911 dispatcher.
Right. 911 procedure, they ask a lot of questions of Meredith. What are some of the questions they ask her immediately, initially?
Well, they asked her what had happened, and Meredith said she didn't know, whether her sister had a pulse. And Meredith also didn't know, because she actually had never checked to see if she had a pulse. She had never actually gone up and touched her sister's body. So at that point, she's directed to do those things, and when she touches her sister's body, it's cold, and she reports that. She's eventually instructed to try and turn her sister's body over so that she's face up so that she can try to perform CPR. And she basically tells the dispatcher, her body is so twisted and it's so heavy, she can't do that. And then she also says her body is ice cold. It's stiff, suggesting that rigor mortis has set in. And at that point, the dispatcher basically gives her permission to cease any further life-saving efforts, because it's very clear that Michelle is dead and has been dead for some time.
Now, you talk about the circumstances that Michelle, investigators immediately find out that she is 4.5 months pregnant with this baby boy that they've already named Rylan. And also that this is, you talked about the third anniversary and where Jason was at this particular time when this 911 call was made. Tell us what investigators find at the crime scene in terms of forced or non-forced entry? Tell us what are some of the things that they deduce from that crime scene initially.
Initially, there were no signs at all of any forced entry. The only blood found in the house was on the top level, and I've already described blood in Cassidy's bathroom, and there was also not only blood on the floor of her bathroom, there was blood smeared all over the walls of her bathroom, very clear that she had played in her mother's blood. There were streaks and smears at a very low height on the walls, including behind the door of Cassidy's bathroom. There was a baby doll that was set out next to Michelle's head in the master bedroom that Cassidy had clearly placed there, and there were some of Cassidy's footprints there right around Michelle's head. So they found all of those things, but downstairs the only blood that was visible was on the doorknob of that same kitchen door that Meredith had entered from on the reverse side, the kitchen side. There were a couple of small drops of blood there. All of that blood was eventually determined to be blood from Michelle. No one else's blood was found at the crime scene. The blood spatter went as high as the ceiling in the bedroom. It was very clear that there was a beating that was inflicted upon Michelle. When you looked at her face, you saw that her teeth had been knocked out, her lips were cut badly, her jawbone was actually protruding through her skin on her face. It was very clear that her head had been beaten either with a blunt object or with a fist many, many times. She was dressed. There was no indication of any type of a sexual assault. The only thing missing from the bedroom, there were two drawers in a jewelry box out of a total of three that were not there. They were missing. And then Michelle's wedding and engagement rings that supposedly she always had worn were also missing from the ring finger of her left hand. Those were the only things that appeared to be missing from the house. There did not appear to be a robbery of any kind at all.
Now, you talk about the investigators and the initially are assigned to this case, and then the medical examiner trying to determine the time of death to be more accurately pinpoint when she was killed in actuality. Now, investigators have to find out and determine about Jason's whereabouts during this time. Tell us about their efforts to contact him. How is Jason first notified about the death of Michelle? What is his reaction? Tell us those circumstances. And then tell us his reaction to finding out about that police are interested in questioning him, talking to him.
Sure. So Jason was on a business trip. There's no dispute about that. Jason went, he had a business meeting that was supposed to take place at 10 o'clock on November 3rd in Clintwood, Virginia. He was selling electronic medical software. Electronic medical records software, that was a big thing that Barack Obama's president was pushing, was getting physicians and hospitals to convert paper records into electronic records, and he was selling software that would allow hospitals and doctor's offices to do just that. He had just started this company called Chart One, and he had a meeting at a regional hospital in Clintwood, Virginia, the morning of the 3rd. So he had decided he was going to leave home on the 2nd to break his trip into two legs, and he was going to stay at a Hampton Inn hotel in Hillsville, Virginia, which is kind of in the western mountains of Virginia, before heading almost to the Kentucky border to Clintwood the next morning for his sales meeting. So that's what he did. He went and had this sales meeting. He was apparently about 30 minutes late to the meeting. It didn't go well. They didn't buy the software. And then he drove south through Asheville, North Carolina, another hour to his home in Brevard, North Carolina, which is where he grew up. And he was going to spend the night there with his mother and his stepfather. He pulls up to the curb, and he gets out of his car, which was a Ford Explorer. He slings his suit jacket over his shoulder, and he starts walking up to the front door, and he notices that his mother, Pat, and his stepfather, Gerald, are standing on the front lawn, and they have very worried, anxious looks on their faces. And he walks up to them, and he says, "What's wrong? Is it Grandma?" And Gerald, his stepfather, looks at him and he says, "No, Jason, it's Michelle. Michelle is dead." And Jason's immediate reaction, according to both his mother and his stepfather, was that he fell to his knees and he started sobbing immediately. And they basically had to catch him before he did a face plant into the ground. They brought him into the house where he was sobbing uncontrollably. And eventually, later that day, they make the decision to head back to Raleigh, which is some 5 hours away, east, 5 hours east, all across North Carolina. And they drive, and along the way, Pat is in the back seat with her son, Jason, and she's receiving calls here and there, and one of them is from law enforcement indicating that they want to speak with Jason. And when Jason arrives at his sister-in-law's house, Meredith's house, law enforcement seizes his Ford Explorer, and he receives several more requests to meet with law enforcement. Jason says he's not going to do that, that he's already had contact with a lawyer's office, that he's going to meet with a lawyer first, and he's not going to have any communications with law enforcement until he's done that. And so that's how that started.
When you say that Meredith is very close with Michelle and very close to Jason, so much so that she has been agreed to be the nanny for their child. So there is a closeness in the relationship. When Meredith discovered or found out or heard that Jason was not going to answer any questions from police, did she think she was of exception and that he would talk to her, he would speak to her? Did she naturally believe that he would say something to her regarding this?
I don't think that's clear. I don't get that much into Meredith's mindset. So the information that I had for this book in my research did not come directly from the participants, from the family members. It came from the trials where they testified about these sorts of things, and both through their testimony that I watched on video footage and transcripts that I read, I was able to glean certain things. That's not something that I was able to glean, but what I can tell you is that Meredith already started suspecting something about Jason that very night that he came to the house. Because they went to the back porch and Meredith was encouraging him to try to speak with the police, and he was refusing. And at one point, he hugged her on the back deck, just lamenting what had happened. And he, in her view, was basically fake crying, that there was something that didn't seem genuine about the way that he was crying that made her suspicious on that very night. So she was suspicious right away that Jason might have been involved in Michelle's murder.
Right. Now, as you do, you talk about Michelle Marie Fisher, and she was born in Sayville, Suffolk County, Long Island, and her dad, Alan, and her mother, Linda. And Linda's quite an important character in this story, certainly. Tell us about her life growing up and then how eventually she was to meet Jason Young.
Michelle grew up in Long Island, as I mentioned earlier, as did I. She grew up, she was about 10 years younger than me, she graduated from Sayville High School in 1995. By all accounts, she was an energetic, vivacious, just full of life teenager. She cheered because her mother was the cheering coach at Sayville Junior High School. So she was cheering in junior high school, and then she was cheering in high school as well, and eventually was the co-captain of the cheerleading team. And they won, they were co-champions, I think, of all of Long Island as a cheer team. She actually, when she went to NC State, she was on the cheering squad at NC State as well. She made straight A's throughout high school. She made basically straight A's throughout college. She was an incredibly gifted student. She made friends extremely easily. And she was a very pretty woman and had a smile, as people would say, that would light up a room. Demeanor was such that people wanted to be around her and people enjoyed her. She formed friends that lasted a lifetime, several of them who feature prominently in the book. She wound up meeting Jason when she was celebrating, I think it was her 22nd or 23rd birthday at a local Raleigh bar with, of course, a cluster of friends. And just so happened that Jason Young, who had graduated from NC State a couple of years before Michelle, Jason Young was in the bar that night himself with a cluster of his own friends, and Jason was kind of a goofy, silly guy. He could be very charismatic, but he could also be very wild. And that night, true to form, he was being a little bit wild, and he knocked over her wine glass. And they struck up a conversation, which is the very first time they had ever met one another. And there was somewhat of a spark, and that spark eventually led to a romance.
You talk about their personalities, and people have said opposites attract. Tell us how opposite their personalities were going into this relationship.
Well, Michelle was described by everybody who knew her as a meticulous planner, somebody who wanted to chart out every aspect of her life. She wanted to have she had her whole wedding designed and planned out before she even met Jason. She knew exactly what she wanted from a wedding in terms of, you know, what the decorations would be, who would be there. As an accountant, she was very meticulous about work. She had great jobs. She started out after getting her master's degree at Deloitte & Touche. And then she wound up working eventually for Progress Energy, a Fortune 500 company that's now part of Duke Energy, in their accounting and tax department. Everything about her was planned, meticulous, and top-notch. Jason, on the other hand, as people were wont to say, flew by the seat of his pants. Didn't plan anything out. Basically, he wanted to encounter life on a minute-by-minute, second-by-second basis. And he wanted to pull pranks. He wanted to make people laugh. He wanted to entertain people. And he would do basically anything to entertain his friends, to have fun. He would get drunk frequently at parties, at tailgates, at football games. And sometimes when he got drunk, he did some things that were pretty shocking, like he did something that I refer to in the book because everybody else talked about them as his dick tricks, where he would actually pull down his pants and use his genitalia to perform in front of other people, male and female. Mm-hmm. And this was who Michelle, this meticulous planner who got straight A's throughout high school and college, this is who she married.
Now, you say despite her elaborate wedding plans and floral arrangements and the white picket fence dream and the house full of kids, by summer 2003, she learns she is pregnant. And they are living together. But what is Jason's, this frat boy that can't grow up, what's his reaction to the news of the pregnancy?
Well, there are two different versions of his reaction. There's his version, which he provided testimony about in the case, and then there's the version of a friend, a lifelong friend of Michelle's, who describes Michelle calling her one night in that same time period in sobbing in tears. And what she reported Michelle told her is that Michelle had told Jason that she was pregnant, and Jason basically told her in no uncertain terms that if she didn't abort the baby, she would regret that decision for the rest of her life, and that he would never be able to forgive her for not aborting the baby. And that was very poignant testimony in the second trial. That is not the way at all Jason portrayed that decision-making process and what he thought of when he learned that she was pregnant. He described it as, you know, it was a shock to him, and he was not sure he was ready, but he was perfectly happy to have Cassidy as his child, and very quickly came around to the decision to propose to Michelle as the result of knowing she was going to have a baby.
To give some credibility to what he said, how does he act during the pregnancy in terms of preparation for the baby's birth?
Well, Jason, again, he wasn't the planner. He wasn't the person who figured things out and made sure things were the way they needed to be. That was Michelle, and to some extent, Michelle's mother, Linda, who did those things, and Jason was kind of along for the ride. He wasn't a big part of planning for the baby, planning for the wedding. In fact, He just wanted to make sure that the wedding itself wasn't falling on a Saturday that would conflict with an NC State football game, because he couldn't have that. He wanted to make sure there was plenty of beer at the wedding. And apart from that, he was more than willing to cede all wedding planning responsibilities to Michelle and her family. And the same was pretty much true for the baby, other than the fact that if the baby was going to be a boy, and this turned out to be true for Rylan, who Michelle was pregnant with at the time of her death, well, the baby couldn't wear any clothes that were blue, or at least not that shade of blue that conflicted with NC State. NC State Wolfpack is red, and light blue is the color of the Carolina Tar Heels. And so Jason was an avid Wolfpack fan and hated the Tar Heels and wanted to make sure that any clothing that was purchased for his children didn't suggest that he was a Tar Heel fan.
Tell us about Michelle's mother, Linda, and what Linda's impression of Jason was, and also the circumstances in which they found themselves in terms of an argument over Linda's role in the baby's life.
Okay, and so Linda was a school teacher, which ironically, so was Jason's mother, Pat. And Linda, because she was a school teacher, had summers completely to herself. And after Cassidy was born, she would spend large chunks of her summer living with Michelle and Jason. So the first summer after Cassidy was born in 2004, she spent the summer living at the townhome they lived in. The next summer, they had moved into their home on Birchleaf Drive, and she spent large portions of that summer there, as she did the following summer in 2006. Linda was a New York-raised, New York-bred woman in her, at that point in time, in her 50s, and she had very decided views about things and about her daughter, and she very quickly came to consider Jason as not good enough for her daughter, that he was very immature, irresponsible, didn't pull his weight in their marriage, and especially after Cassidy was born, didn't pull his weight with child responsibilities. Instead, he would go off and do things like join basketball and softball leagues. And even though he worked from home, he was never at home when Linda was there. And she grew very dissatisfied with the way he was pulling his weight and treating her daughter. Jason, of course, found her to be very intrusive. Moving in on their new home in the summer of 2005, almost the day that Jason and Michelle moved in. And he couldn't stand her and didn't want to have anything to do with her. And that created enormous turmoil and conflict as we head into 2006. And then, of course, Michelle gets pregnant in 2006. And Michelle tells Jason that she's planning to convert the third floor attic into a bedroom and bathroom, essentially a mother-in-law suite, for Linda to move in. And Linda, at that point, has retired from teaching altogether. So the thought is that Linda's going to move in and be Rylan's nanny after he's born and in early 2007, and that Jason's going to have to see her pretty much every day. And Jason said, no way, that is not going to happen. And they were also having fights about whose houses they were going to stay at over the holidays in 2006 and the extent to which Linda would be part of that. And Jason was pushing as hard as he could to limit Linda's time with them over the holidays. And, of course, Michelle, who loved her mother dearly, was pushing for the opposite. So there was enormous conflict over things like that.
Hey guys, it is Ryan. I'm not sure if you know this about me, but I'm a bit of a fun fanatic when I can. I like to work, but I like fun too. It's a thing. And now the truth is out there. I can tell you about my favorite place to have fun. Chumba Casino. They have hundreds of social casino style games to choose from with new games released each week. You can play for free anytime, anywhere. And each day brings a new chance to collect daily bonuses. So join me in the fun. Sign up now at ChumbaCasino.com.
No purchase necessary. VGW. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions. 18 plus.
Step into the world of power, loyalty, and luck.
I'm going to make him an offer he can't refuse.
With family, cannolis, and spins mean everything.
Now, you want to get mixed up in the family business.
Introducing The Godfather at ChumbaCasino.com. Test your luck in the shadowy world of the Godfather slot.
Someday, I will call upon you to do a service for me.
Play The Godfather, now at ChumbaCasino.com.
Welcome to the family.
VGW Group, no purchase necessary. Void where prohibited by law. See terms and conditions, 18 plus.
You talk about Jason's excitement in anticipation of their baby, Rylan, that being a baby boy. Why was he particularly, he said, excited about having a son?
Jason's father, Bob Young, died of cancer when he was only 5 years old. And Jason was the only son born to Bob and Pat Young. Therefore, he was the only one of the three children that had the ability to carry down the Young name into another generation. And so Cassidy, of course, presumably was not going to carry the Young name down after she got married. So having a boy gave Jason the ability to have his father's memory preserved by the Young name being passed down to another generation. And he was very excited about that. Jason is also very manly, liked being a man, and having a boy or a son to do sports-related things with, I think, really appealed to him. So he was really looking forward to having, by all accounts, but to having Rylan as his son.
You talk about, too, that once they had the dream home, they both agreed to prepare their wills. Some people might find that unusual. Why was this something that was important to them, especially?
It was important to Michelle, actually, more than it was important to Jason. Michelle, being the meticulous planner that she was, wanted to make sure that everything was in order, everything that was in place, including should they meet unfortunate circumstances. And the wills actually led to a discussion about life insurance, and somebody that was a sorority sister of Michelle's helped them both with respect to wills and powers of attorney and living wills, and also bouncing around ideas about life insurance. And Michelle, because she was a CPA, was able to get some fairly inexpensive life insurance through the North Carolina chapter of the CPA Association, and was able to procure a $2 million life insurance policy for herself and for Jason, which had a double indemnity provision, meaning it would pay $4 million in the event of a death that was accidental. There was a $4 million policy essentially in place on Michelle's life at the time she was murdered.
Incredible. Let's use this as an opportunity, Stephen, to stop for a second to talk about our sponsor, FabFitFun. The 2019 FabFitFun Fall Box is on sale now. FabFitFun is a woman's lifestyle subscription box filled with full-size premium beauty, lifestyle, fitness, home, and wellness products sent right to your doorstep each season. We take the hassle out of shopping by doing it for you. Each box is customized to your specific interest. We deliver the seasonal must-haves you need. These boxes sell out fast, so sign up for yours today. My wife, Lisa, was very excited when she received her very first box. She was initially very surprised and then very impressed with the high-end products the box contained. Most of the items in each box are customizable, and Lisa received and ordered Bobble Bar, Farrah ear crawlers, and a Kate Spade lunch tote. Her favorite product of all was the Amika Strand Perfect Ceramic Styler. Remember, the FabFitFun membership also goes beyond the box itself. Members can gain access to members-only flash sales called add-on sale. Browse around the website, FabFitFun.com, to explore and become more familiar with the brand. FabFitFun is a seasonal subscription box with full-size beauty, fitness, fashion, and lifestyle products. It retails for $49.99, but always has a value over $200. Use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. That's use coupon code MURDER for $10 off your first box at www.fabfitfun.com. Now, Stephen, we were just talking about what the investigators were learning about the dynamics of the relationship between Jason and Michelle and all the precipitating factors that might have led to his possible murder of his unborn child and his wife. and leaving Cassidy to, again, as we mentioned, walk through the blood of her mother. When investigators look at the forensic evidence, when they get the search warrants for vehicles and homes, tell us about the investigators' quest to get forensic evidence tying Jason Young to this murder.
Sure. And so it obviously started that same day with doing tests around the house using a chemical called phenolphthalein to see if they could detect any more traces of blood. And they were, of course, looking for bloody fingerprints because that would tie the finger and the hand of whoever that hand belonged to the murder. They were not successful in finding any bloody fingerprints other than Cassidy's. They did find two sets of shoe prints that were made in blood, which were promising leads that were made on a pillowcase. They had those sent off for analysis and testing at the State Bureau of Investigation. Obviously, there was a medical examiner who very quickly determined that Michelle had indeed died as the result of blunt force trauma to the head. She had been beaten some 30 times, mostly in the head. There were lots of lacerations in her skull. As I said, she was hit so hard that her jawbone protruded through her through the skin on her face. So they were able to determine that she was beaten pretty viciously. They also were able to determine through the medical examiner that she defended herself. There were lots of marks on her arms and hands suggesting that she had deflected some of those blows, and that was significant to investigators because they were able to determine that there was a struggle, there was a fight. So they had Jason come in, as they're allowed to do under the law, and they got his blood, they got his saliva, and they also photographed every nook and cranny and square inch of his body. And the very shocking thing to them at that point was there wasn't a scratch mark on him. And that seemed very counterintuitive if he was the killer, because Michelle had clearly defended herself. The other thing that they found that was surprising, if Jason in fact was the one who had killed her, was that there was not a sign of blood in his vehicle. And remember, he was at a hotel in Hampton, at the Hampton Inn Hotel in Virginia. And he had to come back some 2.5 hours if he was the one to have done this crime. And he had to be in his vehicle a whole lot of the time. And if he had done all of these things, and it was a very compressed timeline, if he was going to make that meeting the next day, and they actually were able to trace his cell phone pinging a cell tower in Wytheville, Virginia, at 7:40 the morning of the 3rd. So they knew, you know, at best he had some hour or so to have committed this crime, gotten back in his car, driven up there, and still made the meeting the next day. There surely had to be some kind of sign of blood or something in his car, and there wasn't. There was no sign of blood in his hotel room either. They searched that. What they did find at the hotel, though, was one of the things that led them in the direction of Jason Young. His key card was used only a single time when he checked into the hotel and went to his room the very first time at about 10:54 on November 2nd. There are cameras showing that he left his hotel room. He was pictured at the front desk of the hotel, actually wearing a different shirt than he had been wearing at the time he checked in. And they show him, another camera shows him walking down the hallway right about at midnight, again wearing that different shirt. That was at midnight on November 2nd, just before the clock turned to November the 3rd. And that's the last time his whereabouts at the hotel could be documented. So we know he would have left about midnight, and he's back in Wytheville, Virginia at 7:40 the next morning. So what did they find there? They found these things. First, there was a rock propping open an emergency exit door exactly in the direction that Jason was walking at midnight. Second, they were able to determine that the camera in that basic location had been disabled, unplugged, at 11:20 the previous night, about a half an hour after Jason checked into the hotel. When it was determined that that camera was disabled, they were able to get it working again. They plugged it in, and then at 6:30 on the morning of November 3rd, all of a sudden the footage from that camera that was pointed toward the door and the hallway, the footage from that camera was of the ceiling. The camera had been pushed up to the ceiling at about 6:30 that morning. Those discoveries and the fact that Jason was wearing different clothing at the front desk than he had checked in with just an hour before and also that that clothing was never found among Jason's possessions, all pointed strongly in the direction that Jason had left the hotel, traveled to Raleigh, North Carolina, killed Michelle, and then came back to Virginia to preserve his alibi.
You also talk about the footprints, the shoe prints, and the extensive investigation to try to find out if they could match that to footwear that he wore. Tell us a little bit about the hush puppies and size 10 and 12 prints.
Sure. So there were clearly two distinct shoes that were found. Eventually, it was both the FBI and a product specialist from Hush Puppies that helped the North Carolina State Bureau of Investigation figure out what the first shoe was easy to identify. It was a size 10 Franklin Air Fit shoe, the type of shoes that were sold at Dollar General stores, very cheap $10 pairs of sneakers. Jason, by the way, was size 12, so that was somewhat enigmatic. What did that have to do with Jason? The second pair of shoes, though, was eventually identified to be Hush Puppies orbital shoes, size 12, which was the size Jason wore. And not only did Jason wear size 12, he had purchased a pair of Hush Puppies orbital shoes a year before the murder occurred. Actually, it was about a year and a half, July 4th of 2005. And Jason, at trial, contended that Michelle must have thrown those shoes away. But some pictures of Jason that were made from the footage of him both at the Hampton Inn, yes, and also at the Cracker Barrel where he had dinner the night of November 2nd, were shoes that looked very similar to the Hush Puppy orbital shoes that the product specialist from Hush Puppy said those shoe prints were from. And so those tied fairly closely to Jason Young, even though he said that Michelle must have gotten rid of those shoes. They were never found, along with the clothing he was wearing the night of the murder. So, again, that's something else that pointed at him directly, although the size 10 shoes were very enigmatic. The other thing that was very enigmatic was Cassidy. Cassidy, remember, she was under the covers in the bedroom. She had walked through her mother's blood. She had played with the blood in her bathroom with her hands, with her feet. Clearly, there had to be blood all over that child. And yet, when Meredith found her at 1:15 the afternoon of November 3rd, as Meredith described it, she was shockingly clean. And that no one was ever able to explain, not the prosecutors, not the family members, not the SBI, not the detectives who investigate the case. No one was able to explain how that happened.
There's a couple other things that are very interesting in continuing in that thread in terms of how Cassidy could have been so clean despite this crime scene, but also that the red liquid found in a dropper and a medicine bottle and why that could be at least technically tied to Jason because of his job. Tell us what they found.
So Jason worked, before he worked at Chart One selling electronic medical records software, he worked at a company called Pan American Laboratories, and he sold pharmaceuticals. One of the pharmaceuticals he sold was called PanCough PD, which was a cough medicine for adults. In addition, the lead detective, Detective Spivey, when he got involved in the case, one of the first things he did is he started looking through pictures. And one of the pictures that he focused on was of a hutch in Cassidy's bedroom. And on that hutch were two different bottles. One was of adult strength Tylenol in a liquid, and one was the PanCough PD. And he also noticed that there was a dropper sitting next to one of those bottles, and it had a liquid in it. And he eventually had that liquid sent off for testing, and sure enough, it had a mixture of some of these adult-strength medicines that included dehydrocodone, which is something that will cause drowsiness in an adult, let alone in a 2.5-year-old child. And Jason, having known about these kinds of drugs from having sold them, clearly would have known what the side effects of those drugs were. And the theory very quickly became that Jason had given Cassidy, perhaps when he entered that home before he killed Michelle, perhaps after he killed her, given her a bunch of this medication in order to get her to go to sleep, and that after as he was getting ready to leave the house after committing the murder, cleaned her up, put her in the bed. She was fast asleep, and she stayed asleep for the many hours between then and when she was discovered at 1:15 the next afternoon by her aunt. And that was the working theory throughout the case, that she had been drugged.
Right. Now, you talk about Sergeant Spivey and the police's need to be able to speak to people along the way and potentially at gas stations, because this timeline depended on he had to stop, and they needed records of those gas stops to be able to make their case and to be able to prove their timeline that the theory espoused. Tell us who they found at one of these gas stations, remarkably.
They found a woman named Gracie Calhoun or Gracie Doms or Gracie Bailey. She went by different names at different times. They showed her a picture, and she was located in King, North Carolina, at a convenience store / gas station, at the Four Brothers convenience store. And they showed her a picture of Jason's vehicle, and they showed her a picture of Jason, and they asked her, did this man come to this store sometime in the early morning hours of November the 3rd? They were there a few days later, and they asked her a few days before, did this Ford Explorer, this white Ford Explorer, and this man show up and get gas at your gas station? And she said, yes. She said, I remember very distinctly this man came in after buzzing on the pump several times because it was early morning hours. We wouldn't allow the pumps to be on until somebody came in and showed identification. He came in. He was angry. He cussed at me, and he threw a $20 bill at me, and then he pumped his gas, and he left. And she became an important witness for the prosecution to establish that Jason was not asleep at a hotel at 4, 5, 6, 7 in the morning. Rather, he was on his way back from having committed this murder, ran out of fuel, needed more fuel, and filled up at that gas station that was some hour away or so, 45 minutes, I think it was, away from the hotel in Hillsville, Virginia.
Now, you talk about in the book, too, the personal fight at the same time all of this is going on, this investigation, is that Linda and Meredith are suffering separation anxiety, basically, from not being able to see Cassidy and worrying about Cassidy's life. A couple attorneys, Paul Michaels and his brother, are approached by the district attorney, Howard Cummings. What does he ask them to do, and what does he believe this endeavor legally might be able to end in result? What's the end result of what this person would like to have these attorneys do on Linda?
Well, because the forensic evidence wasn't coming together the way that the Wake County Sheriff's Office had hoped it would, and the way that Sheriff Donnie Harrison needed for it to come together in order to go to the grand jury and get indictment against Jason. They were somewhat stuck. Again, the forensic evidence was not clearly pointing at Jason, and they needed some help. So the assistant district attorney in charge of the case, Howard Cummings, got a couple of personal injury lawyers involved, Paul and Jack Michaels, to see if they wouldn't file a wrongful death case against Jason on behalf of Michelle's family to basically turn up some new evidence, possibly even take Jason's deposition and get him under oath as to what had happened, since he wasn't talking to detectives. And they filed that wrongful death case, and Jason didn't respond. He defaulted, allowing judgment to be taken against him. And that judgment was eventually signed by a judge named Donald Stevens, which among its findings included a provision declaring that Jason was the slayer of Michelle under North Carolina's slayer statute, and for that reason, barring him from recovering any life insurance proceeds. Remember, there was a $4 million life insurance policy that was ready to be paid out. It didn't get paid out to Jason because he was determined to be the slayer, and instead that money was directed toward Cassidy as the next lineal descendant of Michelle Young. So no evidence was actually gathered because Jason didn't respond. However, that wrongful death judgment against him would loom large in later proceedings.
Now, talk about the grand jury indictment and what happens as a result.
So by December of 2009, now over 3 years after the murder, everyone's getting somewhat impatient. Ultimately, the district attorney's office decides they have as much evidence as they're going to have. It's time to move forward and put the evidence before the grand jury. They did. Sergeant Spivey is the only witness who testified before the grand jury, and his testimony was convincing enough that they indicted him fairly quickly. Leading a posse of sheriff's officers to head from Raleigh, the five-hour trek to Brevard, North Carolina, in order to arrest Jason, which they did in early December of 2009.
Now, tell us how they proceed with this grand jury indictment.
It's just so the way the grand jury process works is there's no defense attorney involved. It's a one-sided fight. The DA gets to put on any evidence they want, and so they basically called Sergeant Spivey to basically go through with the grand jury all of the evidence they had amassed, which would have included things like the hush puppies' shoe prints in that were the same size Jason wore. It would have included things like the propped-open door at the Hampton Inn, the camera being tampered with twice at the Hampton Inn. Would have included interpersonal stories between Jason and Michelle, Jason and Linda, and all of the turmoil that was going on in their marriage and in Jason's life. Those types of things would have been presented. Grand jury proceedings are secret, so I didn't have access to them in writing the book, but presumably those are the types of things that would have been presented to the grand jury, and then the grand jury would have deliberated and come to a decision that they were going to sign the bill of indictment, which meant that at that point Jason was formally charged with first-degree murder.
Okay. Now you talk about the Judge Stevens would be presiding over the trial, and this is for June 2011, and Brian Collins is the public defender, Wake County, and he was an appointed, and Mike Klinkosum. Both excellent attorneys, as you say, and the DA is Colin Willoughby, and he's assigned Howard Cummings and Becky Holt to lead up the prosecution.
Let me correct that slightly in that Howard Cummings was leading the prosecution but was not able to participate in that first trial because he had just tried another very complex murder case. So David Sachs, another attorney in the district attorney's office, actually filled in as the second chair attorney. Becky Holt was the first chair prosecutor in that first trial.
What you write about, though, too, is with the replacement of Howard Cummings because of the previous case he was working on, David Sachs was the most inexperienced attorney of the lot, wasn't he?
He was, but he was not an inexperienced attorney by any stretch. In fact, David Sachs had been involved in the Michael Peterson murder case when he had been part of the DA's office in Durham County. Michael Peterson is, of course, the staircase murderer, so to speak, where his wife was found at the bottom of a staircase in Durham, North Carolina, and he was ultimately convicted of killing her, although he was later released from prison. And David Sachs was one of the more junior lawyers involved in that case several years before this trial.
Now, it's very interesting, and you have already alluded to more than one trial. So let's talk about what happens at this first trial and the obviously successes and failures of that first trial and why. Tell us what happens in this trial. Tell our audience.
Well, a lot of the trial focused on the forensics. And what was interesting is that the DA's office, Becky Holt and David Sachs, put on a large quantity of forensic evidence, the vast majority of which did not point at Jason Young. And, of course, his defense attorneys hammered away at all of the things that did not point at Jason Young. No blood in his hotel room, no blood in the car, despite the fact that it was one of the bloodiest crime scenes you could imagine. All of the things that were unexplained, like Cassidy's shockingly clean appearance, like the size 10 shoe prints. And so all of these things were thrown up to cast reasonable doubt in the minds of jurors. But the most probably the high point of the trial from a theatrical standpoint was when Jason Young took the witness stand, much to the surprise of the prosecutors. And for a couple of hours in his direct examination, mesmerized the jury with his testimony about his love for Michelle, his wife, and the life that they led together. And though it wasn't a perfect marriage, and though he had made mistakes, in fact, he admitted to having affairs, including a very active affair at the time his wife was killed, that he had nothing whatsoever to do with her murder. And it was convincing testimony. The cross-examination was very brief. It only lasted some 50, 55 minutes. And it didn't make a lot of progress in establishing that Jason was involved in his wife's murder. The difficult questions that he could have been confronted with, he was not. I think the prosecutors were actually not expecting him to testify and were not prepared to cross-examine him. They did the best they could, but he got the better of the prosecutors rather than the other way around, which is not the way it's supposed to be. And that resulted in the jury, for the most part, finding reasonable doubt. Eight of the jurors were, at the time the case was mistried because the jury did not come to a unanimous decision, eight of the jurors had decided they would have voted in favor of acquitting Jason. Four of the jurors hung strong and prevented that result, and as a result, Judge Stevens declared a mistrial, and that led to the case being tried a second time about 7 months later.
Tell us about the issue of the judge mentioning the Slayer statute designation at trial. Tell us when that occurs and how that issue works.
So that did not happen in the first trial. The first trial, as I said, focused a lot on the forensic evidence, and then the real pinnacle of that first trial was when Jason came to the witness stand in his own defense. In the second trial, a lot of things were different. The prosecutors really wanted to do things differently, and Howard Cummings at this point is back in the first chair. Becky Holt slides to second chair. David Sachs is not part of the second trial. And they wanted to do a lot of things differently. They focused less on the forensic evidence. They focused more on Jason and Jason's mindset and the relationship and the troubles in his marriage. The affairs that he had were more pronounced in the second trial. That he had had a former girlfriend that became a fiance who he had actually attacked in a hotel room in Texas during that relationship was played up somewhat more prominently than the first trial. And then the other thing that was mentioned in the second trial that had no role in the first trial was the wrongful death judgment that Judge Stevens himself, the trial judge in the criminal case, had signed when Jason defaulted, when Paul and Jack Michaels filed that case several years earlier. And that was brought to the jury's attention when the clerk of court, a woman by the name of Loren Freeman, who eventually became the district attorney, she was called to testify about the case file in the wrongful death case, and testified that a wrongful death judgment had been entered against Jason, declaring that Jason had been the slayer of Michelle. And that fact was put to the jury as if it was a fact they should have been aware of. And though an objection was made initially by Brian Collins, there was very little objection thereafter to this testimony coming before the second jury.
Right. Now, you talked about, too, that the information that he, when he was on the stand in the first trial, they were able, the prosecution, to be able to have the jury hear that entire testimony in the second trial, weren't they?
Not only were they able to do that, they used that, instead of it being an effective defense for Jason as it was in the first trial, they were able to use it as a prosecution sword in the second trial. Why? Because they had 7 months to pour over everything Jason said from the witness stand in the first trial. Remember, he hadn't spoken a word to anyone, not law enforcement, not his family, not his friends, about his whereabouts and his circumstances in the days leading up to the murder, the day of the murder, before he took the witness stand in the first trial. So they didn't know what he was going to say. But after the first trial ended in a mistrial, they knew everything he had said. And every fact that was in his testimony was thoroughly fact-checked with all the evidence that the sheriff's office had amassed over all those years. And there were several inconsistencies between what Jason said from the witness stand and the facts they had amassed. And Sergeant Spivey went through them one by one in the second trial before the second jury after they had played his videotaped testimony from the first trial. And that was a very effective way of establishing that not only was Jason not the charming charismatic guy that he presented himself as to the first jury, that he was lying about a number of things, including his whereabouts the night of the murder, whether he was asleep in his hotel room, what he was wearing, and so forth. And that ultimately, I think, was the reason why the second jury unanimously found that, beyond a reasonable doubt, that he had killed his wife.
Right. Now, as a result of that second trial and that conviction, how do we get to this continuing? Tell us what happens.
Well, this case had more twists and turns, as one of my reviewers, Justice Bob Edmonds from our North Carolina Supreme Court, said, than the road from Manteo to Murphy, which is basically going across the entire state of North Carolina. So April 1st of 2015, I think it was when this case it was April 1st of 2014. This case had another twist and turn, which is when the Court of Appeals of North Carolina, and this was no April Fool's joke, threw out the conviction. They threw out the conviction because of the wrongful death evidence coming before the second jury. That the second jury should never have learned, the Court of Appeals said, that Jason Young had been found liable civilly for the wrongful death of his wife and that he had been declared the slayer in that civil case. And that made it look like there was going to be a third trial of Jason Young. So much to the elation of his family, it looked like he might get a third shot to convince the jury that he wasn't guilty, and much to the consternation of the Fisher family, who had been fighting for justice by that point for some 7.5 years, they thought they were back to square one, and that they were going to have to go back to a courtroom and have a third trial of whether Jason had in fact killed Michelle. Now, that's not what ultimately happened, because the state Supreme Court ultimately undid the Court of Appeals decision and said that Jason's lawyer's failure to object to that evidence coming before the second jury, or at least object as often and in the right places that they should have been objecting, essentially was enough of a default on their part that the court could not say that Jason had received an unfair trial because that evidence came in. That it was their obligation to object, they had not, and therefore the only question remaining was whether their failure to object had deprived Jason of effective assistance of counsel. And for that purpose and that purpose only, they sent the case back down once again to the Wake County Superior Court, not to have a trial of Jason's guilt or innocence, but to have a hearing on whether he was deprived effective assistance of counsel that he's owed under the Constitution. And that proceeding eventually did occur in June of 2017 before another Superior Court judge named Paul Ridgway.
You talk about that ineffective counsel. What was the decision on that, obviously?
The decision by Judge Ridgway after essentially a full day's hearing in which Brian Collins, who by then was a sitting Superior Court judge himself, he was the key witness about whether he had made mistakes sufficient to grant Jason a new trial. Judge Paul Ridgway's 50-page or so decision was that whatever the failures occurred in the representation of Jason, they didn't change the outcome, that the outcome of his guilty verdict was controlled by many other pieces of evidence, and that the wrongful death evidence, even if it had not come in, would not have changed the outcome. And therefore, he ruled that Jason had not been deprived effective assistance of counsel, he was not entitled to a new trial, and that decision was ultimately affirmed by the Court of Appeals, and it has since been reviewed by the North Carolina Supreme Court in May of 2019, and that is where this case, in my view, reached its ultimate end, which was actually just a few weeks before my book was published.
Incredible, incredible. I guess this was obvious, incredible relief, not a closure, but a relief for Linda and Meredith and their family, Fisher family. Tell us about Cassidy afterwards today. Where's Cassidy?
So the book does not cover that subject because I did not have intimate knowledge about Cassidy and what her life has been since. Obviously, we didn't go into this, but As part of the custody case that that occurred before Jason was arrested, he agreed to give up custody of Cassidy to Meredith, which did occur before he was arrested, and Meredith has had custody of Cassidy ever since. So basically from kindergarten until now, Cassidy has been raised by Meredith here in North Carolina. She is currently a rising 10th grader. She, by all accounts, is doing well. And has flourished despite these awful circumstances that have surrounded her entire life. And so those who I have some friends who have children that have gone to school with her, and what I have learned from them is that she's doing amazingly well here in 2019 as a 15-year-old.
Fantastic. And how about Jason Young? Where does he sit, supposedly, for the rest of his life?
For the rest of his life, he will be in a cell at the Alexander Correctional Institution in western North Carolina, not far from his family. He has been sentenced to life in prison without the possibility of parole, and presumably he will die in prison.
Interesting. I want to thank you very much, Stephen, for coming on and talking about Murder on Birchleaf Drive, the true story of the Michelle Young murder case. It's been fascinating. For those that might want to take a look at this book or in other work, tell us if you have a Facebook page or a website for this book.
Please. Well, the book is available on Amazon. You just research Murder on Birchleaf Drive. You should find it pretty quickly. I also have a website that has tons of information about this case. You can actually watch both trials on my website from beginning to end. The website is www.murderonbirchleafdrive.com.
Thank you very much, Stephen B. Epstein, for a fascinating interview, Murder on Birchleaf Drive. Thank you very much. You have a great evening.
You're welcome. It was a pleasure. Enjoyed participating.
Thank you. Good night.